So first of all, thank you so much for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. Where to begin? Maybe some folks know about me, others don't. I've been working in Latin America now since the 80s. In fact, I mentioned before the meeting here, my first time I was arrested for civil disobedience was at Water Tower Place with Kathy Kelly when I was 19 years old. In 1988 against the war in El Salvador. So I was very proud about that. And I've been working in Latin America ever since, most recently very much in Colombia. I've been there, I don't know, I've lost track scores of times since about 1999, all around the country. And then have been focused on Venezuela as well in recent years. I was been to Venezuela about four times in the last year. So I think the main gist of my talk is about Colombia and Venezuela, but I'll probably talk about other countries as well. I always tell my wife, I can't wait to hear what I speak about tonight. You know, I like to go off script. So if I would give a title to my talk, though, it would be A Tale of Two Countries, Colombia and Venezuela. There are two countries, obviously, that are side by side in South America. And yet the press coverage of the two countries is very different. So on the one hand, you have Venezuela, where you will hear in the press. I tend to listen to NPR, so that's where I would judge how the press in general, including the liberal press, covers Latin America. Venezuela is in the press almost every day, and it's usually something bad happening there, a protest, shortages, whatnot. Colombia is almost never in the press at all. And what is the difference between these two countries in terms of their crises in human rights? Again, judging from the press, we would think that Venezuela is the country with a huge humanitarian human rights crisis. In fact, that's how it's portrayed, with Venezuelans fleeing a unstable country for Colombia, right? In fact, that is what is portrayed almost every day. In fact, quite the opposite is true. So let's start with Colombia. Colombia has many distinctions, all bad. Colombia is the country in Latin America, in fact, in the hemisphere, leads the hemisphere in forced disappearances. Many people might associate Argentina and the Dirty War with forced disappearances, right? They had 30,000 forced disappearances during the Dirty War in the 1970s. Colombia has had 92,000, three times that of Argentina. Since 1984, 80 Catholic priests and three bishops have been murdered in Colombia. According to the Catholic Bishops Conference of Colombia, it's because they advocated for the poor. If this were Cuba or Venezuela, with those types of statistics, those countries would have been vaporized by now. Colombia has nearly 8 million internally displaced people, second only to Syria. A disproportionate number are Afro-Colombian and indigenous peoples. In addition to that, 6 million Colombians have emigrated to Venezuela. 6 million. They are now citizens. They get full social benefits, full benefits of citizenship in Venezuela. It is true that thousands of Venezuelans have left Venezuela recently for Colombia. Most of them were Colombians who had left for Venezuela to begin with and are returning home. But the numbers are nowhere near the millions that have left Colombia for Venezuela, right? And why would they leave? Because Colombia has, by far, and I would stake my life on this, I would stake the souls of my grandchildren in the name of Vito Corleone, the souls of my grandchildren, on the fact that Colombia has the worst human rights in the hemisphere. 80 human rights leaders have been killed in Colombia in the last year. There are 7 to 10,000 political prisoners in Colombia. Even according to the most right-wing anti-Castro Cubans, there's only several hundred political prisoners in Cuba. Right? There's thousands in Colombia. I just looked before I even started talking tonight to make sure I had my figures and analysis right. I looked at the most recent analysis from the International Trade Union Confederation based in Geneva. This is, I guess it'll show bias on my part, the kind of traditional anti-communist trade union confederation as opposed to the WFTU. They have listed for last year the 10 worst countries in the world for labor rights. Colombia is one of those. Venezuela is not. Colombia, in fact, is a Category 5 country for labor rights violations, meaning that they have an exceptional violation of labor rights in that country. Venezuela is Category 3, meaning that they're kind of middle of the road in terms of those issues. Colombia continues to be the most dangerous country in the world to be a trade unionist. 19 trade unionists were killed in Colombia last year. That is the largest number in the world, which is incredible. They only have 50 million people. You know, you might think, well, China has a billion. Certainly, just by sheer numbers, they'd have the most, or maybe India. No, it's Colombia. And they have been the number one country year after year after year. As many folks in this room know, since 1986, about 4,000 trade unionists have been killed in Colombia. It's outrageous. And again, this is a country with only 50 million people. And, you know, it has gone down over years, that's true. But as Chomsky has mentioned, for example, when he was talking about human rights violations in El Salvador during the Civil War, you know, at some point there's less and less, you know, human rights leaders or trade unionists to kill, right? In Colombia, less than 1% of the workers are covered by a labor contract, less than 1%. Their union movement has been crushed by years of violence and years of abuse. Again, according to the IETUC, in addition to the murders, there have been over 200 incidents of violence against trade unionists in Colombia in the last year. These are threats. These are attempted killings, disappearances, kidnappings, etc. And so, you know, to be a union leader, to be a human rights leader, an indigenous leader, an Afro-Colombian leader in Colombia is to really take your life into your own hands. And again, to me, it does baffle me. I understand how propaganda works. I understand all those things. But it still sincerely baffles me that you don't hear any of this on the news, even if for the pure salacious interest in some of it. So, for example, there's a town in Colombia that you might have heard of called Buenaventura. And this is a port town. It's mostly Afro-Colombians. And Buenaventura was supposed to be the model city for the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And in fact, even before it was passed in 2012, under Obama, of course, Bush had been unable to pass it, but of course the left totally laid down and Obama was able to pass it in 2012. For years, Buenaventura had been preparing for the free trade agreement by building up ports. It's a port city on the Pacific coast. Well, another group that was preparing for the free trade agreement were the right-wing paramilitary groups in Buenaventura that wanted control over the ports. And how have they done that? Again, you can read very mainstream human rights organizations to see, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. The paramilitaries have forcibly disappeared hundreds of people in Buenaventura. And they, again, I'm citing Human Rights Watch, a fairly middle of the road even to conservative human rights group. They have chop houses in Buenaventura where they cut people up with machetes and the chainsaws. so that people can hear their screams to terrorize the neighborhood. Again, one might think just for the pure ability to sell newspapers that someone might discuss this in the mainstream press in the United States, but they don't. You don't hear about Buenaventura at all in the chop houses. Again, though, I would refer you to Human Rights Watch, which does discuss these things. Almost every day, I work with all kinds of groups in Colombia. Again, indigenous peoples, Afro-Colombian groups, labor unions. Almost every day, a leader in one of these groups is murdered. Just last week, there had been an Afro-Colombian leader that I'd worked with was murdered about a month ago. Just last week, his two children were murdered. Right? It's not enough to just murder the activist. You have to kill their kids as well. And this is Colombia. And again, there's an absolute blackout of news on this. And of course, we know why. You know, Chomsky and Herman talked about this in manufacturing consent. It's because Colombia is the U.S.'s number one ally in the region. It is our beachhead. We have over seven military bases we operate from there. Alvaro Uribe, the former president of Colombia, who was ranked, by the way, at one point as number 84 top drug trafficker by our Department of Military Intelligence, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from George W. Bush. Right? He was happily welcomed to the White House by Obama. This is a guy who is known to be a leader of paramilitary groups there, but he was very welcomed in the halls of Congress and in the White House. In fact, we tried to sue him. I'm a lawyer by trade. I do a lot of human rights work. We tried to sue Alvaro Uribe for his crimes in Colombia. He, of course, given his horrible crimes in Colombia, was a guest lecturer at Georgetown University, the Catholic Jesuit University. And we served him with papers to sue him for a number of genocides, which he was a part of. And the State Department intervened, the Obama U.S. State Department, and wrote to the court and said, no, this is going to hurt U.S. foreign policy if you allow these people to sue this great man, Alvaro Uribe, this drug trafficker and paramilitary leader. And so the court did not allow us to sue him here. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, yes, are there problems in Venezuela? Absolutely. Are there shortages? Absolutely. But again, the press doesn't talk about why these things exist. So first of all, we have to start with the premise that Venezuela is an oil producer, that they get about 80% of their revenue, federal revenue, from oil sales. They're criticized for the fact that they're a mono, you know, culture, that they over-rely on oil. But that's, of course, a problem that they've had long predating Hugo Chavez, and it's a hard thing to break. In any case, very shortly after Nicolas Maduro was elected in 2013, the oil prices in the world collapsed from around $120 a barrel to as low as about $25 a barrel. So immediately, overnight, they lost about 75% of their revenue. Now, what country could possibly sustain that, right? And by the way, this wasn't an accident. According to the Independent of London, a very reputable newspaper, Saudi Arabia intentionally flooded the markets with oil to lower the oil prices. And why? To undermine Iran, in particular, and Russia secondarily. But as again, the Independent said, in fact, in the title of their article, while Saudi Arabia did this to hurt Iran and Russia, they devastated Venezuela. Of course, the U.S. was quite happy with this, so that worked out great for the United States. And again, while the press will sometimes allude to that fact, I think there's never an emphasis on how badly that hurt the Venezuelan economy, which, as we know, for year after year since Chavez was elected, Venezuela had been very successful in lowering poverty, lowering extreme poverty. And even after the oil crash of 2013, which has never right? It never fully recovered. I think we're only now at $60 a barrel or some, still less than half of the peak. They have built 2 million homes for the poor in Venezuela. They provide food for the poor there under a program called the CLAP program. They continue to spend 71% of their federal revenue on social programs, which is incredible, which has prevented an even worse crisis than they have now. In fact, I'll give a little anecdote, and this blew me away. This really blew me away, especially in light of what's happening in Puerto Rico. I don't know if you're a Democracy Now. A couple days ago about Puerto Rico, they had a great story. And they had Naomi Klein on, right, from Canada. She did the book, The Shock Doctrine, right, how the capitalists use chaos for profit. And she's been going down to Venezuela, to Puerto Rico, because she is investigating how the hurricane in Puerto Rico is being used by the super rich to remodel Puerto Rico, right? They want to make Puerto Rico into a giant resort town, right, for rich people, and to detriment of regular people there. And this is not surprising. So there's a huge battle happening in Puerto Rico right now between the governor and the rich people he represents. He's trying to privatize all of the utilities down there, including the electrical grids, which, you know, still aren't working for many people. And again, the oligarchs of Puerto Rico want to use this crisis and this chaos as a means for their own ends to remodel Puerto Rico. We see this time and time again. Hurricane Katrina was used that way in New Orleans, right? Every natural disaster or man-made disaster is seen as an opportunity, right? This is a context for what I witnessed in Venezuela, which blew me away. I was there in March. I was there for Hugo Chavez's the fifth anniversary of his death, and I went to the Department of Vargas. And the governor there took us on a tour of the state. The governor was the supreme commander of the armed forces under Chavez. He became the supreme commander because he was one of the loyal military leaders who helped save Chavez during the 2002 coup. He's a great guy and he's very popular. You may remember in 1999, very shortly after Chavez took office as president, there was a huge mudslide in Vargas. It displaced hundreds of thousands of people. It's a horrible disaster. And Chavez immediately moved people out of Vargas so they could rebuild, and they've largely rebuilt the whole state of Vargas, and people have moved back. It's actually a great success story. But what blew me away, so we were driving down the highway. On one side was the beautiful ocean, and it was a very blustery day, so the waves were huge. It was very, just one of those days you want to go surfing or whatever. But on the other side were the homes that had been rebuilt. Now, if this, I can guarantee you, again, on the souls of my grandchildren, if this were the United States, if this were Miami, what I would have seen after that disaster and the rebuilding would be condominiums, right, and hotels. No, they were homes for the poor. There were kids out there playing soccer, people out there with their clothes on the line, right? Right across the street from the beach. This is unacceptable, right? This isn't how the world works. This should have been a home for rich people. But this is how things are in Venezuela, where poor people are prioritized, right? And that's why they support the revolution. And what is happening in Venezuela is class warfare. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's not to say that the government hasn't made missteps. They have. It's not to say there's not corruption in Venezuela. There is corruption. And there's corruption that predated Chavez, and it continues to this day, and it has to be fought, and it's beginning to be fought. There were some Citgo officials who've been arrested. I just saw there were some other officials arrested this week for corruption. I think they're finally trying to deal with that. But even despite all those things, you still have a government which, for all of its faults, is aligned with the poorest people in Venezuela. And that's why they still support the government. That's why they saved Chavez during the 2002 coup. As many of you know, if you've ever seen the movie The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, you will see this. It's an amazing thing that happened. Probably the first time in history that I can think of, the third world leader who the U.S. tried to overthrow and who did, was saved by the poor of the country. They still, with all their reservations and criticisms, and they have plenty, they back the Maduro government because they know that, in essence, it is on their side. And moreover, again, compared to Colombia, where the Afro-Colombians, the Afro-descendants, are at best second-class citizens, if not worse, and the indigenous people as well. In Venezuela, after Chavez, the Afro-Venezuelans are for the first time a visible people with their rights respected. And in fact, you know, I've been at demonstrations there during electoral campaigns. One that really struck me, I was at a Maduro rally in 2013 when he was first running for president. And what struck me is that the crowd was nearly totally black. Afro-Venezuelans have benefited from the revolution and are probably the most militantly in favor of it. And to me, when I see that sort of thing, I know who I support, right? I'm with them. I'm not with the other guys. And we know that during some of these violent protests by the so-called opposition, they targeted people because of the color of their skin. If they saw a black person, they assumed that they were Chavist, and some were killed. They were lynched. They were burned to death, right? This is a class warfare. This is a race warfare. And again, for those of us who care about the poor, who care about workers, who care about indigenous people, who care about Afro-descendants, those are the people the revolution has defended the most, and those are the people who support the revolution. Meanwhile, of course, the other thing I haven't even gotten to, aside from the oil collapse of oil prices, are the sanctions. The UN Human Rights Council, which tends to be pretty conservative, just yesterday passed a resolution condemning the sanctions against Venezuela as an attack against the people and the poor of Venezuela. This was a resolution that was sponsored by the Non-Aligned Movement. Remember the Non-Aligned Movement? You don't hear much about it these days, right? Fidel Castro was one of the first leaders of it. They've had some very illustrious leaders. In the last 10 years or so, the leaders of the Non-Aligned Movement have switched between Iran and Venezuela. And in any case, they have over 100 countries that are members of the Non-Aligned Movement. And they sponsored this resolution which passed, which, again, is pretty amazing. And it only stands to reason, though, that these sanctions are killing people in Venezuela. And I'll give some examples of this. When I was last in Venezuela, we were given a great presentation about this, about the fact that a number of companies, either because they're ideologically aligned with those trying to destroy Venezuela and or are merely afraid of how sanctions affect them and may get them into trouble, will not sell critical items to Venezuela. Or they will sell them and just not provide them. So, for example, Venezuela has bought insulin from companies, given millions of dollars for the insulin, never to have it delivered. They have bought cancer medicine for children, only to have it never delivered. They have bought food from private companies, paid it in good money, only to never have it delivered. Sometimes the companies refund the money. Sometimes they refund some of it. Sometimes they don't refund the money. They just don't deliver, right? You can imagine, obviously, that what this is doing to the population and to the healthcare system. It is undermining it. And so when you see things in the press or on social media about people dying in hospitals from a lack of resources, from a lack of medicine, from a lack of chemotherapy or whatever. It's not that those things are untrue. They're true. But you have to look at why they're true. And the efforts that the government's making to address these things and how the sanctions are leading to those shortages. And then when they don't get those things on the Western market, they will turn to China, for example, for help. Or when I was in Venezuela in March, I met a good friend of mine from Iran who happened to be there, and he said, well, we're in town for this memorial for Chavez, but also we're here to see what medicines we can provide for Venezuela. So they're also looking to countries like Iran. The point being that there are, while again, the government has made its own mistakes that have definitely, you know, come back to haunt them, the sanctions and the economic warfare against that country cannot be at all underestimated. And I think as folks who are trade unionists, who are peace activists, we have to oppose these sanctions. And we have to oppose these threats of military intervention, which are very real. The guy who will now be, I guess if he's approved by the Senate, our Secretary of State, the highest ranking diplomat of the United States of America, might be Mike Pompeo, who was the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. He has no diplomatic experience at all. And when he was the head of the CIA, he admitted that he had been working with Colombia and Mexico. He had been talking to them about the steps they could take to change the regime in Venezuela. He may be our next Secretary of State. You got John Bolton, who's the National Security Advisor now, who has also called for regime change in Venezuela. I think the possibility of some sort of military move against Venezuela is not out of the question. I mean, again, in 2018, to think that you might see the U.S. Marines in a Latin American country invading seems preposterous. But I think that that sort of thing might happen, or it might happen by proxy through the Colombian military or through Brazil. And that's certainly what the Venezuelans are afraid of. So I think, again, I think it's very critical that we oppose Western intervention in Venezuela in the form of sanctions, in the form certainly of any military intervention, and that we allow Venezuela to survive. You know, what is happening in Venezuela right now looks a lot like what happened in Chile in the 70s, right, in the early 70s against Allende. It's exactly the game plan that was played there, and it's being played now. And I was 5 years old when Allende was overthrown, but when I was old enough to know what happened, I had been in Nicaragua, I said I would never sit by and allow that to happen again. And it is happening, you know, and I think we need to stand against that in any way we can. There are elections coming up in Venezuela in May, on May 20th. And interestingly, the U.S., which of course always supports democracy and freedom, except when it doesn't, which is all the time, it's come out that Trump actually threatened the opposition candidate, the lead opposition candidate, Falcone, with sanctions if he ran in the election. It's not just that the U.S. wants an opposition candidate to win. It's that they want to utterly discredit the democratic processes in Venezuela. They don't want those elections to even happen. And I think it's up to us to defend those elections. Maduro is calling for international observers in Venezuela. He's asked the UN for observers. So far, they've refused that request. And I think folks who, you know, of goodwill should volunteer to be observers for that election, because Trump has already said before it's even happened he won't recognize them. Other countries are following suit. And again, Trump didn't even want there to be an opposition candidate because they don't want democracy to work there, because they know if democracy works, it will be the Chavistas who come out on top. They want to destroy the revolution by unconstitutional and non-democratic means. That is what's happening there. Okay, well, that's the essence of what I wanted to say, I suppose. But I'm happy to have a discussion about those things. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, is the Carter Center refusing to go and be an observer? I have not heard one way or another. That's a great question. Maybe someone could Google that while we're talking.
I know that the Carter Center condemned the election for the Constituent Assembly in July, surprisingly.
Yeah.
They condemned how it was conducted?
That it happened at all. Because, yeah, a lot of folks said, oh, that's unconstitutional and whatnot.
Oh, you know. Okay.
Which I'm happy to talk about that. I was an observer for that.
Can you talk about that, please?
Okay, yeah. I mean, so in July, there was a vote that took place for a constituent assembly to be seated. In short, it's for a assembly to be seated that would have the power to rewrite the Constitution of Venezuela. However, what's, again, not talked about a lot in the press is that there will be a referendum afterwards. There will be a vote of the whole country to either say yay or nay to whatever comes out of that assembly. In any case, I believe, correctly, pursuant to the Bolivarian Constitution, which is kind of ironic, so according to the Constitution that was held, that was voted in while Chavez was president, Maduro did have the power, I believe, to call for a constituent assembly vote. And it's interesting that the opposition is saying, oh, that's unconstitutional. Yeah, against the Constitution that they oppose because it's a Chavista Constitution. And in fact, when the opposition had a chance to lead the country for 2 days, during the coup in 2002, they threw out the Constitution immediately. Interestingly, we're coming up to the anniversary soon of the coup of 2002. It was in April, but I mention it that we're about up to Easter. I always find it, always have to remind myself that Chavez, who was a devout Catholic, was taken by the coup leaders in 2002 on Good Friday. And he was resurrected on Easter Sunday. That's to power. I always have to remember that. It's incredibly biblical. In any case, so there was this vote in July. 8 million people came out to vote for it. 545 people were voted into the Constituent Assembly. These were people from all walks of life. There were representatives from the Afro-descendants, indigenous, disabled, students, workers' unions. It was an amazingly populist election in a populist body that's now there. And I said at the time, I wouldn't mind a constituent assembly here, you know, those types of people. You know, I could think of a lot of things we could do to change our constitution. In any case, they were voted in July, and they've been operating ever since. And what's very interesting about it was that before the election, Maduro had said this is a vote for peace because there had been a lot of violent protest up until the time of the election. In fact, during the election, 10 people were killed during on election day or on election day weekend. And there was some violence at the polls. But Maduro said, once we have this vote and the Constituent Assembly is elected, we're going to have peace. A vote for the Constituent Assembly is a vote for peace. And some of us were like, wow, okay, that sounds great. I don't know how that is or how it's possible. But you know what? He was right. Somehow, the next day, the protest died down, and it really has been pretty peaceful there since last July. So that is the Constituent Assembly vote. And again, I do think what the work that they're doing has given some hope to Venezuelans that there could be some very positive move forward of the revolution. I mean, I think the folks I know in Venezuela who support the Bolivarian process that Chavez started in 1999, they think that the revolution has to be deepened. It has to go farther. It has to do more to nationalize property, more to defend the poor, more to defend workers' rights. And a lot of folks believe that the Constituent Assembly is going to do just that. So that's that. Yeah.
In Chile, the U.S. worked to overthrow Allende by operating through a sort of favored section of the officer corps. I wonder if you could describe where you see the Venezuelan military is at in comparison. Are they, would you call them the military of the popular forces, or are they divided, or what?
I think for the most part they are the military, the popular forces, because the one thing Chavez did after the coup of 2002, because remember that Chavez himself was a military man and he had a lot of military contacts, he did purge the military. He purged the military of the leaders who had supported the coup. And he did make sure he appointed loyalists as leaders. So I think that the military has been thoroughly vetted since that time. And when I say purge, I just mean he dismissed them. He didn't kill them. I mean, truthfully, Chavez, and I make that point because, you know, again, a lot of criticisms are of Chavez and Maduro that somehow they're strong men and they're undemocratic. Can you imagine in this country, can you imagine if a group forcibly kidnap the president of the United States, say Donald Trump, took him to an island somewhere, tortured him, which is what happened to Chavez, declared a new state, got rid of the Supreme Court, got rid of the Constitution, disbanded the Congress, and then those people in a couple days were themselves overthrown, and Trump was put back as president. What do you think would happen to those people? They'd be vaporized, right? They would be dust on the ground. That's not what Chavez did to those people. Largely, most of those people walked away. Largely, most of those people are leaders of the opposition to this day. I mean, to me, I've said this before and I'll say it again, I believe Venezuela, when you look at the French Revolution, or the Russian Revolution, or Chinese Revolution, or Cuban Revolution. If you compare it to revolutions like that, it's one of the most benevolent revolutions that's ever existed. There's never been mass purges or mass killings. There's never been any guillotines, going down in Venezuela. In fact, I can assure you there are no guillotines in Venezuela. And I just think they deserve a lot of credit. I mean, frankly, if anything, Chavez should have been tougher on those people. I mean, because, you know, revolutions have a right to defend themselves. And it's hurt the poor people that he wasn't tougher on those people because they've come back to bite him, as those type of people do over and over again. But in any case, I think Chavez was special in that way. He wanted to make a revolution in a different way, and I admire that, you know, but it had repercussions. So, in any case, the answer to your question is I think right now the military is pretty thoroughly supportive of the government. But, again, how the world works with money and different things, you never know. You can't count people out. But I do think it's different. I don't think there's a Pinochet waiting in the wings. In Caracas. I certainly hope not. Yes?
So given the fact that manufacturing, distribution, has the Venezuelan people, is the Venezuelan people or Venezuelan government able to produce food, diversify? How does it work?
Well, they're trying very hard to do that. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, we got to give him credit for the fact that they've now lasted almost 20 years. You know, Allende lasted about 3. Which also means, by the way, if the opposition gets in power, the purging, the violence that would ensue would be much worse than in Chile, right? Because they now have 20 years of this to overcome. But in any case, yeah, what is Maduro doing to deal with that? So first of all, as you say, there's been sabotage. There's been cases where the opposition has burned tons of food, right? Has prevented medicine from getting in the country. So the government has tried very hard, number one, to start growing their own food domestically so that they don't have to import it. And they're doing a progressively better job at that. This CLAP program I mentioned, these community agricultural programs that provide food for the poor, those are based on encouraging community agriculture to meet people's needs. So they are definitely working to do that. They are, in terms of medicines, trying to get it from alternative places. And of course, on the grandest scale, Maduro has now created an alternative currency, this petro, this cryptocurrency, which everyone has said was going to be a complete failure. And of course, within, I think, 30 hours, they made $80 billion or something from this cryptocurrency. So, of course, Trump has responded by saying it's illegal for people in the U.S. to even buy it or deal with it, right? So they are doing everything they can to become either, you know, independent, you know, self-sustaining, or at least find, you know, partners in the East like China and Russia and Iran to get their products for. But they're definitely, in terms of food, trying to meet their own needs. And again, this is dealing with years and decades of a monoculture where everything was supplied by oil and they could buy everything on the market. And that works great when the market's working for them, you know, but now the market has turned on them. You know, you can't even get a direct flight now from Venezuela to Colombia, which is right next door. You got to go through Panama now because the main Colombian airline, Avianca, is now boycotting Venezuela. There's only one U.S. airline now that services Venezuela, and that's American Airlines. United and Delta have left. And the airfare is very expensive now. You know, so they are really dealing, and same with Suriname, which is a neighbor as well. They can't fly there directly anymore, you know, because a lot of airlines are boycotting Venezuela. So it's a very difficult situation. You know, they probably will end up like in Iran or in North Korea where they make every nail that they have, you know, because they can't depend on anyone to get it. You had a question.
Why would they not make a coalition with the FARC or ELN? How were their relations and how come they never got to kind of make a more formidable force so FARC couldn't be isolated almost for so many years?
Yeah.
The second question is about Puerto Rico. Do you think it's in the electricity and water problems in Puerto Rico is intentional?
Well, I think just to start with Puerto Rico first, I think a lot of it is intentional. Certainly, they've starved out the public utilities. And certainly, you know, the hurricane response has just been abysmal. I mean, they've let that country fail and they've let the electric grid fail. And I do think part of it is, again, because it's seen as an opportunity to privatize everything. They had one of the best public utilities of the, you know, U.S. since their territory. And yeah, I do think that it's been allowed to fail because they want to privatize it. In terms of Colombia, you know, it's interesting. I think the union movement there has had, well, I don't know. I mean, the unionist I know in Colombia, I can't say we're ever aligned with the guerrillas, even if they had maybe some sympathy. Of course, one of the big FARC leaders, Raul Reyes, did come out of the trade union movement. But I think a lot of folks were, you know, certainly afraid to align too closely with them because that would be more of a death sentence than even being a trade unionist is, right? And of course, now the FARC has disarmed, so, and they're getting killed too. Now, you know, so I don't know. I don't know what options are for the trade unionist at this point. Right now, Gustavo Petro, who's running for president, who's a leftist, who had been a guerrilla, M19 guerrilla, he's now neck and neck for to be president. I hope that he wins, you know. I hope that he wins and lives, you know. But I think it's just very hard in Colombia to have change because of this para-state, this paramilitary state, which has existed there since the 60s, you know, that the U.S. consciously created. It's an incredible struggle there. And I do think, yeah, to be a unionist, I mean, you just have to be, as you say, really the most militant individual by definition, just to be willing to do that, you know. Yeah.
Could you flush out that last statement about the U.S. creating the paramilitary state?
Yeah, so in 1962, the National Security Doctrine was enunciated by President John F. Kennedy. And it was in response to the Cuban Revolution of 59, but also to Vatican II, Catholic Second Vatican Council, which had radicalized the Catholic Church. And so Kennedy was afraid of mass radicalization in the Third World, but in particularly Latin America. So he created a National Security Doctrine, which, of course, as Chomsky notes, had nothing to do with national security and everything to do with crushing popular movements, again, particularly in Latin America. So he sent General William Yarborough to Colombia. It was the first country that we put in place the National Security Doctrine. And Yarborough was very open about the need to create these extra-military forces, these paramilitary forces. He didn't use that word. But they would be armed forces that would not be official military. They would be folks recruited from the civilian population and armed in order to carry out this counterinsurgency. And he said in order to weed out communists. But again, as Chomsky or Father Javier Giraldo, a Jesuit priest in Colombia, who's written a lot about this, has noted, of course, they viewed communists as trade union leaders, indigenous leaders, peasant leaders, and even Catholic priests, who, following the Second Vatican Council, got in their mind the crazy notion that Christ supported poor people and that they would do the same. And so Colombia was the first place where this paramilitary or death squad system was set up. And it has existed. So when people talk about the Salvador option, for example, in Iraq, which we've used, it's really the Colombia option because it's really the first country we tried this out on and then quickly used it in Vietnam as well and have used it ever since in Central America, also very famously in the 80s. And so the system works is that you have these armed groups of people, thousands of them, who are very closely aligned to the military. They get their guns from them. They get ammunition from them. They even get personnel from them. So soldiers during the day, maybe paramilitaries at night. And many times what happens is the paramilitaries are the vanguard for operations. They will go into a town first, subdue the area by murdering people, and then the military comes in right behind. This is very typical. And especially when you have new mining companies coming in to an area, you will always see the paramilitaries coming in first and then the military right behind. And right now how it works, how there's complete impunity, and this actually has raised Yarborough's idea, you know, to its logical extreme, is that both the Colombian and U.S. governments deny that the paramilitaries even exist anymore. So, like, we actually went to the U.S. Embassy and met with the ambassador and said, you know, we got to do something about these paramilitaries. And we were sitting there, a guy, Marino Cordoba, who had been shot at by the paramilitaries, whose child was murdered by the paramilitaries, and he had the U.S. ambassador saying, well, there aren't any paramilitaries. You know, so now they just completely deny the very existence of them. And so this allows the U.S. and Colombian governments to have complete deniability for the crimes that they carry out because It's being done by, as far as they're concerned, these Bakrim, these criminal elements, these criminal bands, who are bad guys, but, you know, they're not us, and we can't do anything about them, right? So, yes?
Well, where did the drug cartels fit in all this?
Well, yeah, I mean, there have been different iterations of drug cartels as well, and, of course, the U.S. has been happy to work with one or other at any given time. Even the, if you ever watch the show Narcos on Netflix, even they honestly allude to the fact that the U.S. worked with one drug cartel to go after another, right? The cartels don't exist as they used to, the Escobar and the Cali cartel. Now the cartels are the paramilitary groups, and the military itself are the biggest drug runners in Colombia. And again, we're fine with that. The U.S. DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, is fine with that because their job has never been to eradicate drugs. It's just to make sure that our buddies are the ones that make money from it, like President Uribe, for example, or the Contras, or whatnot. So, or, of course, in a case of Afghanistan, where the Taliban had nearly eradicated opium by 2001. Now they provide 90% of the world's heroin after the U.S. invasion. So, of course, the DEA does much more to spread drugs than to combat it. But essentially, that's how it works in Colombia. And so these paramilitaries also have incredible political clout because they own a lot of the congresspeople in that country. You know, this was exposed by Gustavo Petro, who had been senator. He's now running for president. And he exposed this parapolitical scandal in which it was shown that hundreds of congresspeople in Colombia were very closely linked with the paramilitaries. And, of course, the highest leader in the land, Uribe, was also very closely connected. And so there's a very good book. It's out of print, which means nothing anymore because of the internet. You can find it, I think, on Amazon, called Colombia, the Genocidal Democracy by Father Javier Giraldo, this Jesuit priest. And he talks very much, it's a very short book. It's very worth getting and reading. Chomsky does the foreword, and it talks about how the para-state works and how the paramilitaries have existed since the 60s in different forms, had different varying degrees of legality and illegality, but that what happens is that every, you know, decade or so, the paramilitaries are somehow wiped out or disappeared or something, but then they, you know, they reform as something else, you know, and so there's always the shell game, which allows them to continue to control Colombia.
You've been talking a little bit about the electoral situation, and I think, and you also mentioned that there's very little news out of Colombia. But I thought I saw some blurb recently that there was some voting that already took place there. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, the legislative votes.
Okay, and that the FARC did very, very poorly in those elections.
Yeah, well, the left in general did very badly, and the right wing did very well.
So why did that happen, and why would the national or the presidential election perhaps be different?
Well, I don't know all the reasons for it. I mean, I suspect that it will be shown that there was a lot of coercion in that election, particularly out in the countryside, that probably led to that skewed voting. That is to say that it was probably far from a free and fair election. So, now, why it might be different in with a presidential election, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people worry that, you know, it may be some indication of what will happen in the presidential election. The polls look good for Petro, again, that he has a shot. But again, whether once people go to the polls, given, you know, that it's not a free and fair election, whether he has a practical chance may be different. And that's why Petro's asking for people to come down as observers to prevent any, you know, hanky-panky down there. Yes, sir.
Is there any mainstream media that is fair-minded about Venezuela in this country?
Mainstream? Not really, I don't think. I mean, I think if you want to find out about Venezuela, there are some good alternative press. VenezuelaAnalysis.org is excellent. Counterpunch has some good things. Telesur, yeah, that's very good. upsidedownworld.org, NACLA. But no, the mainstream press is awful. I mean, just awful, I think. I can't point to one. Can anyone else? I mean, it's just absolutely abhorrent on Venezuela. On other things too, but that in particular.
Does Venezuela have allies in the hemisphere besides Cuba? I mean, for example, Bolivia or Nicaragua? And beyond that, does it have widespread support among the people throughout the continent, or is it propaganda just from sort of too pervasive?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in terms of countries, yes, Bolivia supports it, Nicaragua, as you say. There's a number of Caribbean countries that support it as well. But it is becoming more and more isolated as the pink tide has been rolled back in countries like Brazil that have been a critical supporter, Argentina, Chile, Ecuador as well, despite the fact they have a president named Lenin. It's pretty hostile. So it has a few supporters out there. Now, amongst the populations, I think that they... I find the Latins are pretty hip to what's happening in the world, you know, and I think they do have a lot of support amongst the population, but amongst the governments, there's only a few countries left that are supporting them right now in Latin America.
5 or 6 years ago, there was a lot of solidarity with Colombia in the United States. There are a lot of organizations working on that. A lot of that seems to have disappeared, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, my perception is that the solidarity movement in general has weakened. You know, that there this notion of solidarity with other countries, I mean, my own perception is that it doesn't exist like it used to. You know, when I was...
Across the board.
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, there was solidarity with El Salvador, Nicaragua, Cuba, right? You all remember that. And it's not the case that all that's gone, but it's not the same. I don't think the younger generation has a sense of that. It's not to say they don't have other interests. But the idea of that sort of solidarity movement seems a lot weaker in general, certainly with Venezuela as well. I mean, they're really, Venezuela, I believe, is not getting the support that they deserve from the U.S. left, which I think is confused in general, and we could have a much bigger talk about that. But, you know, I mean, there just isn't a strong anti-intervention movement. I think people are very fooled by the whole idea of humanitarian intervention. They think that we're not supporting human rights unless we're bombing somebody. And I'm not being even facetious. I wish I were. But I actually think that people believe that unless a president is willing to drop some bombs, he doesn't really care about human rights. That's how they felt about, they would Mau Mau Obama about that in Syria. You're not dropping enough bombs, you know. But they were real happy about Libya, you know, which now has open slave markets, right? There are now people being sold as slaves, thanks to Obama and Clinton and Samantha Power, who now I guess they're all saints now. They destroyed that country, right? And no one said boo, and no one's saying boo now about that. There is a psychosis in this country, I believe, on these issues, where liberals believe, where you have Rachel Maddow, a liberal, saying Trump is insane for meeting with the leader of North Korea, right? It's the one decent thing Trump will ever do, is meet with him, possibly. And that is a sin. Now, according to the liberals, there is a sickness that pervades this country on these issues. I mean, maybe I'm getting on my soapbox here, but I probably haven't for the last hour, so why not? But the idea of humanitarian intervention, I think, is one of the worst things that was ever created. In fact, I teach human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, but it's a total Trojan horse. It's all about the evils of humanitarian intervention. That's my whole thing. It is a bad religion, and I think it really has infected people. And so they really... Well, and the other thing is that there's no notion of history. You know, most people don't know who Salvador Allende was, or Pinochet, right? I mean, I always say, in the U.S., history is like the movie Groundhog Day, you know, with Bill Murray, where he wakes up, it's the same day every day. Well, in the U.S., history starts anew every day as far as people is concerned. There's never, there wasn't a Vietnam, there wasn't a Korea, there wasn't Iraq, and then Iraq too, and there wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, so the next war that's based on a lie, we're fooled into because we forgot the last one was based on a lie, right? It's always, you know, again, it's just that we don't learn from the past because we don't even know. And that's what's really, it's very hard to do this work for that reason, because you literally have to start from square one. Again, when I do this human rights class, the first thing I teach is the war in Vietnam. That is my genocidal study. You know, because the lesser genocides that are considered genocides, right, they pale in comparison to Vietnam, you know, where we killed a million, you know, millions of people, 3 to 4, maybe more millions, and, you know, literally bombed a country to the Stone Age. Of course, that's not a genocide as far as most people are concerned, but it's, of course, more of a genocide than a lot of other ones that are considered it. But, you know, my students, they're in law school, so they've been to high school, they've been to college, they are blown away by Vietnam. They have no idea what we did in Vietnam. Yeah, the napalm and the Agent Orange, that raping women was standard operating procedure in Vietnam. That we acted as these other peoples that we look at a lot and say, oh, that's genocide. We got to go bomb those people because they're committing genocide. No, we just got to stop our people from doing it, right? But there's no sense of this. Because there's no sense of history, you know, and the same thing with Korea now. There's no sense of what we did to Korea, which was like Vietnam, but before Vietnam, right? So that's what makes this work very hard, and that's why there isn't much of a solidarity movement. There's no sense of what happened in the 80s to Central America, you know, with these kids that are now coming up here unaccompanied, and people resent that. There's no sense of what we did to their countries to make that happen. We destroyed these countries. In Honduras, we're still destroying, right? We overthrew Zelaya in 2009. You know, it's now come out, there was a guy who was working for U.S. Southern Command who's now come out, he testified in 2016, saying U.S. Southern Command was actually quarterbacking the coup. You know, and we know from Hillary Clinton, who said that she made the coup permanent. She said that in her book, Hard Choices, the hardback, but then took it out for a paperback. Because she was shocked that people thought that that wasn't a good choice on her part. And people are still being killed in Honduras, of course. So, but if you don't know these things, I know everyone in this room knows these things I'm saying. I'm not teaching you anything new, but I'm just ranting about the fact that, I mean, you can't just talk about Chavez. You really have to go back and talk about other things. I mean, one thing I like to talk about, for example, I'll throw this out. I even raised this with Chomsky, and he said, oh, I never thought about that, which I was pretty excited about. So a couple years ago, we celebrated the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. So just to remind you about Tiananmen Square, there were these mass protests against the Chinese government, and between 300 and 3,000, it's hard, you know, people don't really know, 3,000 protesters were killed. None in the square, by the way. That's kind of a misnomer. There were protests there, but the killings happened, you know, in the city around the square, whatever. There are huge 25th anniversary commemorations for this, and of course, there's the poster of the guy in front of the tank and all that. Well,
Where were these commemorations?
Oh, in the U.S. and in the press and all that, Time Magazine and all. You know, oh, let's remember Tiananmen Square. Meanwhile, in 1989, the same year, is the Caracazo, right? In Venezuela, where 300 to 3,000 Venezuelans are killed in protest against the government. Do you remember all the 25th anniversary celebrations of the Caracazo? Do you remember the pictures of the guy in front of the tank in Caracas? Hell no, right? Most people don't know the name Caracazo. Now, which one was more important from a very objective analysis. What happened in China as a result of Tiananmen Square? Nothing. Nothing. The government stayed in power and things went on as usual. What happened in Venezuela? Chavez. Radical change happened. Moreover, while the numbers are the same, Venezuela has 31 million people. China has a billion. So proportionally and historically, the Caracazo was much more important. And yet it's not talked about. It's not. It's a nothing. It's a non-event. Because it's the wrong people dying and it's the wrong people doing the killing, right? And we see this time and time again. And I give that illustration because it shows how American propaganda works. And it works so effectively. Yes?
Did they know about the Obama's kill list? See how many people
right.
know that there are 10 billion entries in Google only under Obama kill list. Nobody knows. How many people? 1% or something. So I had another thing about the everything in the world passes through SWIFT in New York. So, was it New York or is it not in Manhattan? And so they don't accept your money. You
right.
can't pay for this cash for your medicine that you buy.
Well, that's exactly right. And a lot of banks are afraid to do business with them. And the other thing you have now with the newer sanctions is that Citgo, Venezuela's oil company that operates here, they can't get their money out of U.S. banks. So there's billions of dollars sitting here and they can't be used for the Venezuelan people. Well, I tell you what, we're thinking of, oh, we're almost an hour and a half, and my voice is about to give away. So if it's okay, why don't we end there? And I thank you all for coming out. And if you want to buy a book, you're welcome to. I saw on a sliding scale this book here, which has a lot about Latin America. You'd be surprised how much Latin America is in there. And, you know, keep on keeping on and build the solidarity movement. Thank you.